I've been based in Africa for nearly 20 years now, first on behalf of the European Union, and then after I, quote-unquote, retired from the European Union, I joined University for Peace and remained in Addis Ababa. So my perspective, having been based in Sudan, Ethiopia, Djibouti, and for a while in Nigeria during that period, my perspective, of course, is largely African, and I'm happy that Susanna gave you the global picture so I can be a little bit more parochial. Climate change and climate variability, of course, are not new. And if you look at what's happened in Africa, during the last ice age, there was a lot more rain. And in fact, this is not unlike some of the weather phenomena that you're observing now, where there are many more episodes of torrential rains than used to be the case. And this can be partly explained because of rising temperatures and rising humidity levels in the air. Imagine what it must have been like during the last ice age or at the end of the last ice age when the temperatures between air and water were much, the differences in temperature were much greater, leading to more evaporation and torrential downpours. And of course, this also meant that Africa was more humid, but also other parts, you know. If you want to hear about Noah's flood, National Geographic, not so far from here, has made a wonderful documentary about Noah's flood, how rising levels in the Mediterranean, because of course the amount of water on Earth is fixed, whether it is fluid or frozen or in vapor form, you know, it's essentially fixed. So the release of lots of fluid water from the melting of the ice allowed ocean levels to rise. And in the Black Sea was dry at that point. It was just a depression. So what happened, the Bosphorus broke and became a waterfall that went on for decades. And so, well, you can imagine, I'm not going to go into any alternative explanation, but National Geographic, located a few blocks from here, I think, shed ample light on what happened. And of course, it was a result of climate change. So then was the drying of the Sahara. If you look at rock paintings and rock sculptures in Chad and so on, you see crocodiles and giraffes and, you know, animals that we associate with equatorial Africa rather than with the Sahel. But there was then a long period of drying, and just, you know, I don't want to take you through ancient African history, but just to show the potential that these migratory flows can have, people who lived in the Sahara, or what we now consider the Sahara, could not stay there because they could not sustain their livelihood, which was hunting and gathering. And a lot of them moved to the Nile Valley. And I think there's a very nice theory, again, a theory, but a very nice one on the origin of Egyptian civilization, because you had a cross-fertilization of people who had very different perspectives about livelihoods and how to sustain themselves. And this led to I think, this led to a flourishing of civilization in the Nile Valley and the height of Egyptian civilization many centuries afterwards. Global warming, of course, affects Africa, but with regional variations. And I found this map. What I want to, and you know, I go back to don't believe anything if you can avoid it. The assumption seems to be that there is drying throughout the African continent, or that there is less rainfall. Well, sorry, not true. The blue areas denote areas that have received increased precipitation over the last 30 years. The red, decreased. Of course, you know, and this means, for instance, the greening of the Sahel, which is visible from satellite images, is a result of increases in precipitation from about 1990 onwards. This doesn't necessarily mean that the Sahel has become more hospitable in terms of sustaining life or animals, because since there had been overgrazing and there was very little seed reserve in the ground, a lot of the greening actually turns out to be invasive species, which are not suitable as fodder crops. Nevertheless, I mean, the amount of rainfall, I think, has not uniformly declined. Now, if you compare this to population change, of course, some of the areas that have had decreases in precipitation are areas that have had the highest population increase. And of course, this is a problematic issue. And I'm talking here, for instance, about large parts of Ethiopia and Kenya, you know, some of the most densely populated countries in Africa. We often observe scarcity in these regions, and the scarcity results from the effects of climate change combined with the effects of population increase. Because even if the climate wasn't changing, but the population rises at 3% a year, as it does in many of these countries, per capita availability of resources is going to decline. And so very often when you talk of problems that are induced by climate change, even in you know, articles done by scholars who do or should know better, there is no attempt to disaggregate the effect of climate change and population increase. I think luckily, and then of course we base assumptions on how to adapt to climate change on what we observe about climate change or what we think we observe, which isn't always that well founded. The good thing about adaptation is, of course, that in the end we will have to move towards sustainable development anyway, and whether we do this motivated by population increase or motivated by what we think is climate change doesn't make much difference as long as we do it. So the effect is not so terrible. Now, I just want to move to one last map here, which is a map of the U.S., which was published in the New York Times just last week, you know, as part of an article on the current climate change in the United States. And I simply want to draw your attention to the fact that the prevalence of red, that is, regions with declining precipitation, is substantially higher in the U.S. than it was in Africa. So, you know, the overall assumption often formulated that, you know, Africa contributed least to global warming but is suffering the most, you know, I'm not denying the idea that Africa is suffering, but I think that the rest of the world is going to suffer at least as much. In fact, I was thinking of using some photographs because I'm an avid photographer and I make a couple of thousand pictures a year. But the most depressing pictures about trout that I could find when I looked back over what I had done, the pictures I took over the last few months, were pictures taken in January of this year when I was traveling through California, not Africa. Anyway, Susanna spoke about migration, and of course in Africa, I think inevitably there are high flows of migration and they will continue. Population growth, and you know, I'm based in the Horn of Africa, population growth in most of these countries is still 3% a year. And even though there are declines in fertility, that is, family size decreasing from 8 30 or 40 years ago to 4 at this stage, and perhaps going down to 3 in another 10 years, this will not really have a major impact on the rate of population growth, for the simple reason that there's a flywheel effect. You will, in 20 or 30 years, have more young adults than you have now, because these children have already been born. And as they form families, even if those families are smaller, the birth rate on a population basis will essentially remain unchanged. So you're talking about Ethiopia doubling its population in 25, in the best of times, 30 years, and it's 90 million now. So you're looking at, 200 million, I would say, by 2050, almost unavoidable, even if fertility continues to decline. So you will have migration. A lot of the migration will be internal, quite simply because the land, the Horn of Africa still has a very low rate of urbanization. Most people are subsistence farmers, and if a farmer has 8 children, he cannot keep subdividing his land. Everybody will end up having, half an acre and a goat and a donkey if things are going well. So people will have to move to cities, and there will be no possibility for return, basically, because there's nothing to go back to. They cannot have a livelihood in the areas where they came from. So you will necessarily have high migration flows, and of course the drivers of migration are lack of employment, livelihood issues. Most of the migration will be domestic, as it is now, moving into cities. In Ethiopia so far, a lot of the migration has been from one rural area to another, but that is also likely to come to an end because of population increase and because of differences in land use pattern. So what does climate change do with respect to migration? In fact, I think that climate change may accelerate migration, but to the extent that I've seen attempts at modeling, and I can give some references to those who would like, a young fellow called Justin Ginetti has done a master's thesis at Tufts a couple of years ago. All models are crude and all models are wrong, but I think his is probably less wrong than most. But basically, he concludes that climate change adds very little to the expected migration flows, because population increase, land degradation, et cetera, these are the main drivers, and population climate change will add to that, but to a relatively minor extent only. So some of this migration ends up being international, and since I've worked with the European Union for many years, and we may still talk about that afterwards, but this is, of course, a major concern in Europe, that all these people from sub-Saharan Africa will end up trying to cross the Mediterranean one way or another, as is already the case. Nevertheless, the flows of migration toward Europe in relative terms are relatively low. There's a lot more migration traditionally to the Middle East, although some of these channels are now also being closed by Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states becoming more restrictive, and the countries of origin, in particular Ethiopia, refusing to allow people to be recruited because of all the problems that have been reported in the press, abuse and et cetera. But that will not necessarily slow the rate of migration. People will simply look for other areas to go to. And there's evidence that Southern Africa, South Africa in particular, is becoming an increasing choice for those wishing to migrate. Illegal migration to the Middle East has picked up again in the last couple of months after having reached a low during the winter, November, December, January. But the rates going, and most of these are simply crossing from the Horn of Africa, Djibouti, Somaliland, Puntland to Yemen. And of course, you know that the Saudis also are trying to build a fence between themselves, and I'm sure some people have flyers and managed to not to be deterred by that. It's very difficult to stop migration flows. The only suggestion that I would have is that intra-regional migration might provide an outlet for some of the people wanting to go. And of course, this would mean that the regional economic community, which covers Eastern Africa, and I think the same would apply to the other areas, other parts of Africa, would need to expand, that is, would need to provide economic opportunities so that people would go, say, from Ethiopia to Kenya in order to join a boom there, rather than trying to move to the Middle East or Europe. And I think this, you know, the policy avenue here is to encourage regional integration in Africa, because, as you know, the trade among African countries is very low, much lower than their trade bilaterally, either with the European Union or with the U.S. And you know, they need increased sizes of markets, and I think the EU has been a good example that this does work, that would be one avenue to pursue. Last point is impact on security, and this is probably the one that I have written most about, so I'm going to try and be very brief. There's been, a few years ago, an avalanche of publications on climate change and conflict, many of them making very dire warnings about, you know, what's going to happen, you know, people. And all of these are based on the assumptions that climate change will increase scarcity, and scarcity will lead to conflict. Frankly, I don't think that the evidence bears this out. Scarcity can be a reason for cooperation, and there are increasingly studies being done, for example, in pastoralist areas in the Horn of Africa, that indicate that during periods of drought, people actually do cooperate more. They find ways of using the few resources that are left in a more efficient manner. And I would say water use, for example, is an indication. I think there are more treaties on sharing water resources than there are on any other topic. So, you know, we shouldn't necessarily assume that climate change is going to increase the incidence of conflict. In fact, there may be a link, but if there is, it's not quite as direct. Again, using an example from the Horn of Africa, among pastoralists, the incidence of conflict tends to go up after the weather improves. That is, after periods of drought, when the rains resume, then there is more conflict. And, you know, you can give various explanations for this. It's easier to steal cattle because they can hide in the grass, or, you know, you don't need to take them to watering points as often because they don't need as much moisture. And then, of course, from the point of view of the person who's motivated to go out and raid other people's cattle, they may have lost most or all of their cattle during long periods of drought, and they're eager to take advantage of the better conditions to restock their herd. You know, so that, of course, means that there is a link between climate change and conflict, but it's not as simple as you may or has been claimed in many writings. The incidence of governance is crucial. And, you know, my last position for the European Union was as political advisor to the EU Special Representative for Sudan, who was a Finn and who rarely came in the spot. So I dealt primarily with the conflict in Darfur and also represented the EU at the peace talks on Darfur in Abuja. And really, having looked at various sides, we also, University for Peace in Addis Ababa, has links with the three universities in Darfur that continued operating throughout the conflict. And our conclusion really has been that governance is the key issue in the Darfur conflict. It's not a climate war. It's not an environmental war. It's a war that was caused by elites making decisions about resources and neglecting certain other areas. This has been the main driver. And of course, the fact also that over something like a 20-year period, the population doubled and the livestock population quadrupled. That's roughly between 1980 and 2000. And this simply became untenable. So, you know, I think we need to be very careful about linking climate change to security questions. So.